Welcome to Bridging the Gap. We are Alaskans discussing issues that divide us in order to find solutions that will unite us. Welcome to Bridging the Gap. Today is the 18th in a series of panel discussions of Alaskans examining issues that divide us politically in these turbulent times. My name is Paul Thomas, and I live in Trapper Creek. The objective of the panel discussion is to derive, through questions posed to the participants, an understanding of the causes that have resulted in the current polarization of American political discourse. Subsequent to achieving a satisfactory understanding of the causes, it is hoped that through further discussion, a strategy for positive interaction can be constructed, which can achieve a respectful accommodation of each side towards the other. Today is one of those further discussion topics, because we already talked about foreign policy once with Michelle Church and Panthea Redwood, but today we have Mike Molesky and a newcomer, Joseph McGilloway, and the old guy, Warren Keough.
Really old guy.
Yeah, well, we're all here suffering from the same malady, I believe, Warren. Okay, I looked over the questions we asked at the first foreign policy panel, which included Panthea and Michelle, and a lot of the same questions could be asked again today. But history moves on, and even after a few weeks, perceptions and perspectives change as circumstances change. So let's revisit those issues and discuss what they mean today, starting with Trump tearing up the Iran nuclear deal and Pompeo threatening to strangle them with sanctions to the point that regime change would be the end result. Was that a wise move by Trump to tear up the Iran deal? And will Iran start behaving now? Mike, you're our expert here today, so we're going to let you start off.
Well, let me begin by saying I've only spent about a week in Tehran, and that time was during just before and the beginning of Ramadan, and it was a long time ago. And I remember that time because I remember the country. I remember that there was a distinct layering of the population, a large population. Iran has a large population of people. And then there were people running the show at the top. And then there was a maybe what might be called a burgeoning middle class.
Okay, now you're going to have to give us some time here. Is this, you know, during the Shah's regime? Or is it
was at the end of the Shah's regime.
Okay.
I wouldn't say that I ushered him out, but I was there. And that's a good point, because over the years, Iran has had varying positions vis-a-vis the United States. And people forget about the great war that occurred where Iraq and Iran fought for many years. And the U.S. Was trying to figure out you know, Iraq is our ally.
Yeah, my recollection was we backed Saddam in that war.
That's right. And then times changed, and of course we removed Saddam a little bit later. So what I'm thinking is that the way we also offered the Shah an opportunity to live on outside of Iran. The real question, I think, is there any – When you talk about this, is this moment in time when a president who's known for being pretty gut-based in terms of making a decision about something has zigged in a certain way on the stage, but that underneath there really is not going to be the kind of change that will cause Iran to say, okay, we're going to go back, build nuclear weapons, and come attack us? I think, and I would also add that because of what has just happened in Singapore, we're beginning to see that there's an action taken at the highest level, but which does not necessarily reflect the broader connections between the U.S. and these other countries, whether it's North Korea or Iran. These are not simple things to do. It's not as if you can turn a switch on, turn a switch off. And so I would say... Given your question, this is the time to wait and see, because it'll take a bit longer to do that.
Let me repeat the question.
Okay.
For Joseph. Was it a wise move for Trump to tear up the Iran deal?
I don't think so. I don't think it's good to act unilaterally. And when you have your allies arguing with you, please don't do that. I don't think that's a good decision. Purely from that reason, it's not good to go alone. The world is becoming a much smaller place. We need the cooperation of our allies. And when people make unilateral decisions, it annoys your friends. The president's good at doing that.
This particular president. What do you think, Warren?
Yeah. Well, I'd pretty much echo Joe's comments. When your nearest friends and allies globally are saying, don't do what you're about to do, and our president leaps in and does it anyway, I think it's an error. And we haven't made a lot of right decisions in the Middle East in the past two decades, and I think this is just the latest evolution of more mistaken actions. And the other things are at play in the Middle East too that affect the Iran deal. And I for one, I mean, it's just a little off topic here, but the idea to move the U.S. embassy to Jerusalem, what a boneheaded play, in my opinion. I'm sure Trump is beholden to certain Las Vegas billionaire hotel owners that...
I think his name's Adelson.
Yes, it is Adelson. and a few other folks. Benjamin Netanyahu is certainly delirious, happily, about the move of the embassy to Jerusalem. But really, previous presidents have had the acumen to not do such a thing in spite of the urging of others. And it's really, I believe, just unnecessarily poking a sharp stick in the eyes of friendly Arab nations in the Middle East. Just a dumb play, in my opinion.
How did Trump's tearing up the Iran deal affect the American objective of denuclearizing the Korean Peninsula? I'm not talking about Singapore itself. I'm talking about the denuclearization objective. How did that affect tearing up the Iran deal affect that?
Well, I think the important point about the Iran deal is that Trump did not negotiate that and then tear it up. It was the result of a multi-year process. It was a result of work with allies.
Many nations.
It was the work with various agencies within the United States dealing with nuclear proliferation, et cetera. But the more important thing was it was under Obama's watch. And there seems to be a consistent pattern, I think, at the present time to say, looking out at what I'm going to do next today, it's what's next on the list that Obama did that I want to undo. And so there have been people already who have begun looking at the two processes and to say, going to Singapore, doing this in New York, and now Pompeo, as Secretary of State, has suggested that it might take a little over 2 years to denuclearize. Others have said, well, it's going to be a long time. It's a complicated business. And more importantly, on the surface, when you look at the agreement, there was no mention by North Korea that they would denuclearize. Okay? So others have come and said, well, that's what was written, but there's more underneath that. In the world of international relations and working with other countries, many other times in life, what you write down seems to be important. But I think the defining characteristic is the approach, the Trump approach to doing these things is to have the least information that he can use to make a decision.
Hence, no note takers.
No note takers. No advisors, and there have been a number of people who study decision-making, and they say it's easy to make a decision when you don't have much information.
Yeah.
And that's what I think he's taking the easy way out, and as a result, he has torn up one thing over here, but there's no other connection because there are no people. There's nothing in that really allows for a discussion with the president from people within the establishment or agencies about, well, want to consider, having done that, how this affects here. I think they're totally separate.
I think it's. I'm not sure if I'm staying on point or not, but I think the idea that you can meet for 10 minutes and start a problem that people have been trying to work on for decades and you know is just kind of a nonsense, really. Diplomacy is really important part of how we cooperate with each other, even at the level of understanding each other's culture. I mean, how words can be used differently within the same language, even, you know.
I think the big misconception is the word denuclearization.
Yeah.
Americans have one view of it.
Yes, exactly.
And Korean is different.
Yeah, we don't know what the Korean idea of that is, and I don't think we know what the American one is either. I mean, there's because we don't know what the president will say tomorrow, and maybe change the opinion. I think here we're thinking it means North Korea gets rid of its nuclear. Or prevents any further development of nuclear warheads or developing their nuclear power. But I don't know. I mean, what nation? I mean, would America be happy to be told, don't do that?
We're going to get to that later on.
Okay.
I have a question regarding that and other nations regarding the whole nuclear power issue.
Yeah,
we'll talk about that later.
Well, that's, you know, we raise Singapore in the recent meeting with North Koreans and the, you know, if we ask ourselves the question, what's the single greatest threat to humankind and the planet? In my view, anyway, it's the potential of nuclear warfare. I think it's the single greatest threat to the planet. And so, have we reduced the likelihood of that happening by this recent meeting between the United States and North Korea and Singapore? Given the outcome, I don't think we have.
I think what happened was that we were so close to it since the Cuban Missile Crisis. I think this is the closest we've come with the fire and fury rhetoric, and the fact that he had intercontinental ballistic missiles, but he could put nuclear warheads on top of. But then, because we were so close, now we are at least talking, and the belief then.
Well, that's good. It may the. Talking produce a good benefit. But, I mean, I guess I would share the same concern that have been voiced by some, that the president's been played. I mean, the North Korean president has a long history of reneging on deals over the past many years. And if we look in the, you know, Trump announces as he steps off the airplane in the United States that we're all's well, we're that much further away from nuclear warfare. Well, I say horse.
Well,
feathers.
He actually said the threat was gone.
Oh, the threat was gone. Yeah, well, I've
5 minutes. That's all it took, guys. It was pretty.
But in the who has the advantage here? I think North Korea came away with something concrete. I mean, Trump has suddenly arbitrarily canceled the annual military exercises off. On the Korean Peninsula and off the coast of Korea and over the skies of Korea.
Can I deviate a little bit, but just based on that point, is that such a bad thing that we're not having those joint military exercises? Or,
well, speaking as a former soldier and enlisted man, I think that's a dumb play as well, especially when apparently you take the U.S. military forces by surprise, you take the South Koreans by surprise, you're saying, what the hell's going on? And you know damn well the Japanese are paying very close attention, given their near proximity and the history of that they have with one another.
But isn't that a way of de-escalating tensions somewhat?
Well, it could be if there's something in return for it. But what do we have in return? We have some vague language on a jointly signed piece of paper. Militarily, it's he's done this under the purported reason of saving money. Militarily, I would suggest if you want to save money, cancel the parade that's scheduled and save a couple of $100 million there.
Okay, Mike, I know you're ready to jump
sorry.
In.
I'd agree. I would agree with pretty much everything Warren said. I would only add the other piece. I think this is a demonstration, again, of a go-it-alone diplomacy. We started with talking about Iran, and we went to Singapore, and of course we skipped over Quebec and the G7.
Oh, we have time.
I understand.
We're early in our conversation.
I understand we'll get there, but that's the more proximate event that occurred. where basically it appeared that the president was saying, we don't need you, we'll go it alone. And not only, it wasn't so much we, it was a royal we, I will go it alone, and I will go there, and I will make this happen. And now I went, and I actually didn't need all that time, so I'm going to leave early, and I'll come home, and it's done. And in the meantime, whether you're a military leader, is trying to say, we're not doing these, but this is a whole thing in process for training that how do we, you know, we're going to stop that. The South Koreans are saying politely, what? And
Japanese as well.
Yeah, but meanwhile, the Chinese.
Advantage China.
Yes.
That's who comes out on top on this.
They smile and say, oh,
this
yeah.
This is great for them.
Oh, cool. So
Putin as well.
But look at, and also the reports have come in, basically a flood of countries going to North Korea to establish a relationship. I have to remind that nowhere in this discussion in Singapore, et cetera, were the sanctions eliminated. And the sanctions.
Hold on now. There was an announcement on North Korea, official North Korea media, that the sanctions were eliminated. And we don't know what they said because no notes were taken. So who could be lying? Well, everybody could be lying.
Yeah, and it's been reported. Yeah, I heard the same report, but that's what we're hearing. We're hearing it all second, third, fourth hand, yeah.
We don't have an official, we don't have a document.
No.
We don't have something that says, because it isn't only the United States imposing sanctions. There are other countries involved. So once again, have other countries been blindsided in this process? I had to go and look this up. So I went to the CIA fact book, which has the facts. And I said, how big is South Korea? How big is North Korea? Well, there are 50 million people in South Korea, 25 million in North Korea. Okay. But then you look down through all the other numbers in terms of life expectancy and anything like GDP, et cetera, you realize these are two very different countries. Mm-hmm. And so what is being discussed in part is what kind of relationship will North Korea and South Korea have? It might bear some resemblance to what happened in East Germany and West Germany, but probably different. And I think all of those things that we've just throwing up here are sort of left in the wake to be picked up, and as many papers seem to be torn up by the president and then later taped to get back together again. That's what we have as a metaphor for this whole process.
This is KVRF Radio Free Palmer, Big Cabbage Radio. We are bridging the gap here, talking about foreign policy with Mike Bielewski, Joseph McGilloway, and Warren Keogh. Go ahead, Joseph. I interrupted you.
No, you didn't. I'm just thinking. I think I'm on the other side of your other two speakers. I think it's a good thing to escalate any military operations. I think, in general, it sends out a less antagonistic approach, a kind of a more when you have people walking up and down with military maneuvers, you antagonize the person on the other side of the fence. That's just reality. I mean, if your neighbor does it with their gun in their 5 acres next door to you, looking over your fence, you get annoyed. It's the same with countries. And I think making that decision to just quieten things down. I know in my own country when that happened, it changed people's opinions very fast, and changed the atmosphere immediately. So I think that's probably a really good thing for the people, more maybe even than the politicians.
Well, I can agree with your point, Mike and Warren, about the way it was done. It was handled atrociously. I agree with Joseph that the fact that we can go ahead and ease back the military operations, the threatening, it's kind of like, you know, I have a bigger gun than you, so then that's – go ahead.
Okay, but, I mean, I'm all for –
good neighbors?
I'm all for good neighbors. it's a tough nut to crack sometimes.
Yeah.
However, if you step back a little bit further and look at some of the other players and the geography of the place, here we have the president saying, okay, we made a hell of a good deal. We're going to cancel our military maneuvers, which from the military perspective is probably not a good idea. They have those for a reason, practically and symbolically. But I think, again, what's significant is the advantage here is to China. And if you look at adjacent areas, I mean, China has been pushing aggressively to expand its influence in it's Spratly Islands, for example. And so if, with a further diminishment of U.S. presence in the area, if you yank 30,000 American troops out of South Korea, which will make their knees weak, I'm sure. This is a green light for China, I think, in subtle ways, less subtle ways, perhaps.
So, Paul, I guess I've thought as we were getting ready for this, two things. And one, how much we can look back to history, examples, whether it's in Ireland or it's 1939 in Europe, and we're talking about Hitler and Czechoslovakia and the rest of that, how much we can project from that and in an attempt to analyze a situation which appears to be moving so fast that this is a total change where we're looking at an individual who is the leader of a country, North Korea, who have reams of evidence, has guided North Korea into a human rights nightmare. 100,000 people still in one form or another of gulag. And we're saying, okay, he's at a point where his economy is really, really being hurt. And he's willing to come and let the United States greet him and treat him in some respects as an equal. You say, okay, so that means he just had a change of heart and he's going to next ask for groups to come in and help figure out how to do a better job relating to people.
A couple hamburger joint franchises.
Well, what I'm saying is I'm leery of a change of that sort happening. Now, having said that, mm-hmm. we have the other example of the Soviet Union with Gorbachev coming to the fore and a U.S. president and the things that happened there, where the Soviet Union surprised many people by literally collapsing. It collapsed. As an entity turned into Russia, and there were moments there, et cetera, where it looked like it was going to experiment with democracy, et cetera. It then chose another road to bring it to where it is today. But it was the enemy with the largest grouping of nuclear weapons, et cetera, as an enemy, but it collapsed. I mean, it significantly changed. It disappeared. So maybe there's more to be learned in that. As trying to analyze what's happening in North Korea.
I think we also should include from a historical perspective that Joe Stalin was our great ally in World War II. And if you can think of anybody that had a worse human rights record than Joe Stalin, I think we could put Kim and Adolf Hitler in that bracket. But, you know, we sat down with him and we actually aided him tremendously in the fight against our other common enemy, Hitler.
So what are we saying then? Do we have anything that we can look at in historical terms?
But you
that
have
would
to talk
here?
To your enemies. I mean, your friends, you're getting on with anyway, correct? I mean, your friends, your buddies are good.
We used to.
Used to be.
Yeah, well, we used to be. Yeah, well, fair point. Well, you're making enemies of them, so that's kind of that's a different thing. But you need to talk to your enemies, and the reality is your enemies are people you don't agree with. By nature, you do not agree with them. So it's going to be hard and it's going to be difficult. And that's why I have this big bell ringing at the back of my head saying this isn't sorted out, because you can't sort it in 5 minutes. And yet that's what we're hearing. Everything's good. Everything's great. Everybody's happy. The Koreans are happy. The North Koreans are happy because all their sanctions are lifted. The American president's happy because there's no more threat. And it all happened over not even a cup of tea, which we would have in Ireland at least to celebrate it. Maybe something even stronger. But yeah, it just seems a little farcical to me that so many complicated issues could be sorted so fast.
I want to move along to a sort of the same topic, but in a different vein here. And the question is, if the USA, Russia, China, Israel, United Kingdom, France, India, and Pakistan can all be nuclear powers. Why can't North Korea become a nuclear power if all those nations are nuclear powers? We're saying that Iran and North Korea can't. Why is that?
It's a sovereign state. If one nation can do it, I don't see why another one should. I don't agree with people having it in general, and I don't think it's a good idea. But I don't see how you can argue logically that if we have the right to have it here, they don't have the right to have it there. If they're a recognized sovereign state, I don't see the logical argument.
Okay, that's the logical argument. But we have the American position, which doesn't really follow that logical argument.
Well, since I'm the oldest guy in the room, I was...
You're sure about that?
Absolutely. Okay. I know. Where were you during the Cuban Missile Crisis?
I think I was in sixth grade.
Wow, you and I must be the same age. I was in sixth grade, too.
Okay, so I was looking at the photography.
And, okay, you're the oldest.
Which, if you'll give me that. So, in other words, one of the reason why I mentioned that, it was because it was the photo interpreters that actually discovered what was on the ships that were coming in. And it was, of course, JFK who was there and faced with his biggest decision, which had to do with talking to a leader of the Soviet Union and saying, no mas. Sorry, you can go to this line, and then you're going to stop. And that was because the Soviet Union was placing missiles in Cuba, 90 miles away from Florida, et cetera. And the U.S. said, no. This is within our – this is a provocative act, military escalation of – and we don't we can't allow that to happen. So there was a standoff, et cetera. Will or will it not happen? People were on alert, all the rest of this stuff happening. And it was resolved. It stopped with some face saving, so the Soviet Union didn't feel like they'd just been, you know, brushed aside by the U.S.
Yeah, Khrushchev didn't last long after that, though.
Right. But it's an example, one of the earliest ones I have, of one nation looking at a sovereign nation and saying, no, you can't do that there. And the way we're going to stop you is because we're bigger and we're going to stop you. Howard?
It's simply a power equation. I mean, those that have and those that don't. And, given the nature of the weaponry at play, I mean, everyone recognizes the potency of the weapon. So simply from a pragmatic perspective, you know, you want to limit the quantity, one would think, and the spread of these extraordinarily powerful weapons. So,
right, but Israel has them. Mm-hmm. Pakistan has them.
Yeah, yes, I'm aware.
And they're allowed to have them because we say they're allowed to have them. Yeah. But Iran and North Korea aren't allowed to have them because we say they're not allowed to have them.
But does America have them in South Korea?
That's a good question.
My understanding is no.
Okay.
But
the potential's there.
Right.
So the argument you were using about the Cuban crisis, you could say North Korea have the same right to that argument.
Oh, I would say one of the missing pieces throughout all of this is the lack of something that the present administration seems to approve of, which is the lack of multilateral treaties, international organizations, whether it's the UN or a group of people that are in the nuclear club that will come together and say one way to stop this proliferation is not to sell to other countries.
Yeah, exactly.
And that's a non-military approach. But if you don't have that, then if you don't have some agreement, international agreements, then you're faced with someone saying, I'm big enough to make my way.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So we have China and Russia on one side and France, England, and America on the other side. So they all have to agree not to allow North Korea the technology or Iran the technology. And we don't seem to have that agreement, or do we?
I don't think so. If we look at the – I'm not much of a historian, but if you look at the change in the technology of weaponry over time, and we can go back to prehistory, but when have we ever as in humankind in various societies, what are the examples when we've ever been able to say, no, okay, we have this new kind of power. First we threw a rock, mm-hmm. and then we attached a rock to a club, mm-hmm. and then somebody invented a bow and arrow. I mean, I'm being really simplistic here. Mm-hmm. And then somebody invented a catapult. And so we have this gradual progression due to human ingenuity where we can inflict greater harm on our neighbor, someone we oppose, or someone who's invading, or someone we want to invade. So there's been, I mean, if you just look at the advancement in technology in the last 150 years, we've gone from, you know, musket balls to Gatling guns to megaton bombs. So I guess I'm just saying from my own pessimistic dark, we've never really been successful at stopping ourselves, which is worrisome. So I don't know. Maybe you have a what's the cure there?
I don't think there is one that's obvious. But I think it would be a wonderful thing if those nations that do have it would agree to use them in the context of preventing the use of them, to sort of make an agreement together that they would never be used except in the context of potentially a threat to someone who was going to use them. You go back to diplomacy, and that's what we don't have right now.
Let me ask this question then. Would the fact that none of the above listed nuclear powers, which I listed, Israel, et cetera, have ever been attacked by any sovereign nation since they became nuclear powers, mm-hmm. would that fact that they possess these nuclear weapons have anything to do with North Korea wanting to keep their own nukes?
Yeah.
Everybody agrees with that.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. In fact, I think that's been expressed clearly that if we looked at the example of Libya and Gaddafi, that's often offered up. When he backed down to the U.S., ended up dead.
And then Bolton coming with the Libyan model is the way he wanted to approach North Korea.
Right.
Any warm, fuzzy feelings in North Korea after Bolton made that statement?
Nope.
How do our NATO allies view the USA since Trump became president?
Cautiously, worriedly, pessimistically. Our president is a one-man show, a man-child, if I may say, who I would hope that his erratic behavior, you know, his unpredictability, that can be in it. Something of an advantage if you do it consciously, but I don't see that in this man. He's haphazard. He's not well informed, and I think he makes all of our allies, as evidenced recently in this G7 conference, confused, angry, unhappy, feeling less. They have a much less dependable ally, and. Where there has been some recent history where of working together, it's America first, and all you other guys take the hindmost and give him the finger as he leaves the conference early. I mean, come on.
I remember when one time Barack Obama came to Europe for some conference. I don't remember what the conference was, but I remember that it hit the news all over Europe because he was he came to the conference chewing gum. He was chewing gum, and that was like, how rude. No. If that made European news all over Europe, that the President of the United States arrived chewing gum, you can imagine what the reaction is there to President Trump and his comments.
Well, your country's still in the EU, correct?
Oh, yeah, very much.
Okay,
yeah.
So you kind of know about how the EU feels just from being a citizen of the EU.
I guess I got some bit of an idea. I mean, I still keep in touch with I'm living here longer than Trump became president, so I'm not really up to date. But I do listen to the news, British news, European news, and Irish news pretty much every day. So I hear the commentary, and it's not very positive. I guess I'll try and be diplomatic about that. It would not be positive. Really.
We're among friends here.
I know. Yeah.
So what do you think, Mike? How about our NATO allies viewing Trump? What's your take on that?
Well, again, in part, as Joseph has said, you look to a variety of sources. I try to do a spectrum of different observations and look at any raw footage I can of people's statements. I'm guessing maybe leaders in other countries, and I'm going to break this up into two parts. I mean, there's a leadership reaction,
yeah.
Whether it's Trudeau or Merkel, whoever, mm-hmm. and then there's the larger population of people. And I think back to knowing some in my own life, knowing some people that I thought were erratic. I may have worked with them, I may have seen my family, whatever, but they were erratic. So sometimes things seem to be cool, very nice, they've been going along nicely, and then there'd be something that would set them off, and they would be hardwired to a reaction. And that's what I'm observing personally. I'm observing someone who seems to not have very much control of his day-to-day, moment-to-moment situation. And so the recent thing with Trudeau, I'm still trying to parse. I saw what Trudeau said. I saw the statements at the end of the G7. Mm-hmm. And then there's what appeared to be an overreaction by saying he stabbed us in the back. And I'm thinking,
special place in hell.
What did I miss? What was supposed to happen? Because he said,
we won't be pushed around.
He said, we'll sign off on this. Just remember, you haven't taken away your tariffs, and we're going to have to deal with that. That's real life.
Well, the Canadian populace didn't miss it.
No.
Because Justin Trudeau, who was having a few problems politically, is suddenly a national hero. Even his very conservative political opponent who lost the election to Trudeau recently has stepped up. They had some unprecedented unanimous statement or resolution by the Canadian Parliament. So the Canadian people, here we have the people in our close geographically proximal nation, the most courteous people on the planet, rallying behind their leader and
yes.
basically saying to Trump, what the hell are you talking about? Or why, what's up with you? So they get it, and some of us get it, I think. Or I'm with the Canucks on this.
Yeah, and what the thing about it is, it's a good example of what continues to happen. There was a statement that he stabbed us in the back, and I'm thinking, okay, describe that. Show me the knife, or what was it that you're interpreting something. I saw what was said. How is that taken as stabbing you in the back? I don't understand. And that's what I think many people.
I'm not sure that I watched parts of it. I'm not sure about the sequence, but I do remember at some point the president tweeting about the the Canadians being weak or something, or weak spirited,
right.
or something like that. And I think it was about, my understanding at the time was that it was in relation to that statement.
I think he said something dishonest and weak.
Yeah,
I think it was
straight after they'd been shaking hands and talking about. So he got on the plane, then he got on and did the dishonest and weak statement. Which, and my understanding at the time is that that's what they were saying about being stabbed in the back. But I'm not sure if I have my sequence in the right order.
Well, I'm trying to think the last time in American and U.S. history when we've suddenly, spontaneously, in a short period of time, alienated our only two proximal neighbors, Mexico and in Canada. Who else besides President Trump has managed to do that in short order? Maybe we can go back a century or two.
I think that's the other question that I think this whole thing raises is, why go all the way to Korea to make friends with your enemy when you are making enemies of your friends? I mean, what's the purpose of being the big hero in that story when you're destroying all the relationships you already have around the world that have been working right up until you took office? So I'm not sure. I don't know what the purpose is of the Korean effort in the context of all the other things that are being destroyed at the same time.
This is KVRF Radio Free Palmer, Big Cabbage Radio. We are Bridging the Gap, discussing foreign policy with Mike Molesky, Joseph McGilloway, and Warren Keogh. Go ahead, Mike. I interrupted you.
Well, I am beginning to think that the change that has occurred, because as I'm listening and I'm speaking myself, the name Trump appears to dominate our conversation. And I think in some respects, that's reflective of the situation. When we talk about foreign policy today, what we're talking about is Trump, because he is the foreign policy, whether it's a tweet or a meeting of this sort. And given the reduction in the number of people that are available as advisors, people on the ground, ambassadors, people in the State Department in general, or it just in his closest circle who have knowledge of foreign affairs, this has come down to say this man wants to do it himself. And the only models that I have looking in history are people who have been dictators. They have attempted to do this, whether it's a Hitler or a Stalin or, you know, pick the person. And that's why, there are people who have studied foreign affairs, Madeleine Albright, for one, Secretary of State. And she's written a book recently, Fascism.
Fascism, right.
And she's saying, she goes through this very nicely. It's well written. But she's saying, well, this is what we're looking at. All of those, and the question that comes up in relation to foreign affairs or any affairs is, do we have a set of features of our government that will prevent a single person from dominating in this way, which I would submit is a bad thing?
I don't know if this is going to engender much of a discussion, but I'm going to ask this question anyway. Can anyone here explain the trade policy of the Trump administration?
German cars bad.
Tariffs are good.
Okay. No one can explain. Okay. I didn't think so. All right. What are we supposed to think about a Chinese government-supported bank loaning $500 million to a Trump golf course in Malaysia and then seeing a Trump tweet days later announcing that our Commerce Department is directed to help a Chinese phone company, XCE, for the sake of jobs in China, a phone company that makes phones designed to spy on our private phone conversations? What is going on with that? What are we supposed to think about that? Because it was America first, right? Wasn't that the big campaign slogan? And now a tweet comes out saying we have to worry about jobs in China, so we have to support this, and our Commerce Department is going to help with that?
I'm speechless.
Fortunately, I don't feel tasked to explain many of these things. I can react to them.
I have
trouble.
I think a lot of us are in the same.
Let's go to the reaction then. If we can't explain it, what's your reaction?
My reaction is that once again, these are decisions that are made on the basis of some kind of event. Perhaps it's an individual that has had captured the president's attention, and I think it's a quick reaction, and he's basing the tweet and the policy directive on a small amount of information. I just have to come back to that. And there's an expression, he stated that, it's a disdain for a lot of prep, a lot of detail. Mm-hmm. Don't bother me with the details. Yeah. I want something that I can use to jump off with for a decision. And I think that's consistent, as I've read, with his approach to being a businessman, maybe in a variety of areas of his life. And I'm also struck by those people who have described election night as being one where the Trump and his people did not really plan on winning. And when that happened, they had then to step up and say, okay, now what do we do? And I think they're still figuring that out. And certainly if you look at the parade of people that are advisors that have come in and gone, some of them have been good people. I say that because they've had experience and so on. But the best of them seem to have the shortest lifespan. So.
What's your reaction, Joseph?
I think I've heard it said recently that the president has said diplomacy is a four-letter word. And I agree with him, but I don't think he knows what that four-letter word is. It's W-O-R-K. It's work. It's hard work that people have to put in. And I don't think he's maybe prepared to do that. He thinks just snap decisions are good and maybe thinks even that's a sign of power. I don't think so. There's also a reality in some of those decisions that you know, is really not, it's not something to joke about. When someone is as powerful as the President of the United States makes a statement about something, for example, making the putting the embassy in Jerusalem, that has a huge effect on other people. I mean, because ultimately, at the end of the day, the President of the United States is a very powerful person around the world. And the end result of that particular decision was that people died in the streets. Now, whether you agree with their argument or whether you agree with their position or whether they should have been rioting or they should have been doing whatever, the end result is that people died as because of that decision. And I'm not sure the president's aware of the effect of his power. I think he tries to use it sometimes, but I'm not sure that he's completely aware of the necessity for diplomacy and the importance it has in people not dying. That's a big deal. I think that's a really big deal. You've got to be careful about how you speak, how you act, because it has knock-on effects in places that if you do not know the information, there can be severe consequences for that. And I'll leave it at that.
Any corrupt intent? Did you guys
I don't think so.
See that?
I can't see a single thing in him that.
But I would say it's the way he behaves is more a matter of self-interest rather than
ego.
National interest. Yes, yeah. Exactly. Mm-hmm. And given his life experience, you know, he has no history of public service. He's never been elected to public office. He certainly wasn't in the military. So he's a urban businessman of not very good repute, actually. And so if you look at his 72 years of life, what is it that's really prepared him for the position that he's in? And as you suggested, it wound up in a place he probably never really expected to be. And I think many American citizens, as well as other citizens of the planet, are suffering the consequences of.
So, Paul, just one question. I'm curious about this. Who do you think says no to the president?
Are you asking me or are you asking everybody? Because I don't think anyone that says no to him stays in the room very long after saying no to him.
Right. So
that's
so,
my answer to that question.
Yeah. Is there anyone who can say no in a way that there would be a continuing relationship or dialogue or whatever? Because that's the sense I have.
Well, I think that's pretty well documented, too. I mean, perhaps the single best attribute of people that serve him is loyalty. If you're not loyal, if you don't agree, you're out the door.
Mm-hmm. We'll see. Well, the people will have a vote again.
Okay.
So
there will be people who say no.
Yeah, I hope so. It seems to be difficult that people who are willing to do that maybe mightn't stay around too long.
So we're basically talking about this November having an opportunity as the electorate to say no.
To say no, if you will. Yeah.
Well, a report just came out that 1,500 migrant children who were either orphans or separated from their parents were now lost, and that Trump gave ICE permission to destroy evidence of sexual abuse and sex trafficking of these immigrant migrant children. And, of course, we have this issue that's pretty much in the headlines now about separating children from their parents. My question is, are we already revisiting the horrors of Nazi Germany with that situation on the border?
We have foreign nationals making their way into the country illegally. whatever the laws.
Well, not necessarily, Warren, because if you're talking about the people who were coming from Guatemala, Salvador, there are
asylum seekers.
There are asylum seekers.
I understand
right.
that.
And that's not illegal.
Mm-hmm. Right. And so I get all of that. So irrespective if someone is coming into the country for purposes of asylum or otherwise, the idea that it would be the policy and the action of our government to separate a mother or a father from their children is just beyond the pale. I can't comprehend it.
I have a lot of thoughts just running around in my head, but I can't put them in any order right at the moment.
There's a moral outrage. I can see it in your eyes.
There is that. But I think it also has to be tempered with, moral outrage when you see people's lives affected that way. That's not what you would think is a good approach from any reasonable person. But I'm also a person who believes in having good borders and good controls for your nation. In relation to many different aspects of the welfare of a nation. I mean, I've gone through a process of paperwork to be here and to be here legally. My cousin today couldn't get home to his father's funeral. He lives in Florida. His father was buried today because his paperwork is in mid-process at the moment, and he didn't want to leave until that was done. He's married here. So there are issues at times that are very hard for people doing it the legal and correct way, but I do think those things are really important. It's important to know who's coming in to your country. It's important to know that you have security in your country. But there has to be a balance, and I think sometimes it seems like there is no balance.
But the position of the government, and I think Jeff Sessions articulated this, was that is a disincentive for people to come because they're going to be separated, families are going to be split apart.
It would be a disincentive, you'd think, but it depends on how bad your circumstances are.
Yeah, the horror of the gang violence in Guatemala.
Yeah.
You have anything to add on that issue, Mike?
Well, I think what you pointed to is one example of a much larger issue of how to treat the borders. Mm. Obviously, there was from the campaign and now suggestion that you build a wall and you stop this, that you just build a wall. Well, the realities of that, I think, is a metaphor for the whole thing. Well, who's going to pay for it? How's it going to be done? And so in the meantime, you have all of these kinds of things happening that are egregious approaches to solving the problem of how do you have some kind of orderly immigration and review of those people who have been here illegally, et cetera. We're dealing this for a long time. And I don't think there's a sense in my mind that there is an orderly way of doing this, of moving from where we've been to a better place for dealing with immigration. Witness the difficulty even in Congress at the House level, where you have moderate and other Republicans attempting to do this and being stymied as well.
The discharge petition failed, and so Paul Ryan is putting together the moderates caved into the conservatives, and they're not going to have a discharge petition on DACA. So they're putting together another bill now. This just came out today.
So what we're talking about is people at all levels having trouble dealing with, once again, what is being somewhat unilaterally decreed by the president.
Last Friday, just before leaving for the G7 summit in Canada, Trump complained about Russia being excluded. He wants Russia included in the G7 and make it the G8 again. Is the obvious reason Trump is such a strong advocate for Putin's staring us in the face? Is he really saying thanks to his buddy for helping him win the election?
I thought it was going down to G6. That was my last bit of news I got.
Well, he wants to go up to 8.
That implies that he'd return, which is a question.
Well, let's talk about the motivation for him wanting Putin back in.
I don't know. Sometimes I think he's just controversial for the sake of being controversial and getting attention. I don't know. Maybe that's a little...
Well, whatever persuades him, he has... That's one thing about which he has not been unpredictable. He's constantly been a promoter of Putin and Russia. I don't see that changing. Perhaps he's forgotten why the G8 turned into the G7. Russia misbehaved and got to boot.
But, he didn't reference it at all.
Well,
as if it didn't happen.
He may not even be aware. Who knows? Crepes.
Okay. I think I need to go watch a movie again. The Manchurian Candidate. You know, I'm almost there. I'm almost there saying this does not, either there is something connecting Putin and Trump that is an under-the-table agreement or whatever, or the president has some strange fascination with Russia that I've not seen explained. But bottom line, Russia at the present time has not gone back to the place exactly where the Soviet Union was, but it's gone to
the pre-Gorbachev Soviet Union.
Right, but it's gone to a bad place. Mm. And I think people have to understand that. That is not a place to go visit and enjoy the culture without noticing that there's a lot of corruption, there is a large military, there's all of those things that say that Mr. Putin is the single power. He's, like Trump, the person you listen to. And if you don't...
Well, maybe it's just Trump's affinity for autocrats, whether it's Duterte, Putin,
Z,
Mr. North Korea,
Kim. Right?
Mm-hmm. The Turkish guy, what's his name?
Erdogan.
Yes, yeah. And also, we could, have Netanyahu included in
there
that
you go.
As well. Yeah. Although we wouldn't say Netanyahu is necessarily an autocrat because Israel still has elections. Okay, we have 1 minute left, I was told, and what I want to do is let all of you give a final 20 seconds on what do you think we need to do moving ahead. Go ahead, Mike.
Meditate.
Yeah.
Okay. Relax.
You're down to about 10 seconds now.
Okay.
Well, I'm saying relax and not pay attention to every single tweet.
Okay. Joseph.
I saw that the president today said he wants to bring the Korean thing to Congress. I think that would be a great move.
Well, I didn't hear that, but I agree. Mm-hmm. Warren?
Read, listen, be aware, and vote.
Vote this November. It's been a great discussion, guys.
Enjoy.
Really, really appreciate
your
coming in. And that's all for Foreign Policy 2. This is Bridging the Gap. Thanks for listening. Thanks for listening to Bridging the Gap. We welcome diversified perspectives. If you are interested in becoming a panelist for a future show, send us an email to manager@radiofreepalmer.org.
This program is a production of Radio Free Palmer, recorded at our studios in Palmer, Alaska. The views and opinions of moderators and guests do not necessarily represent those of Radio Free Palmer, the station, or its underwriters.